ages. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're listening to episode 552 of Unwelcome Guests, Defective by Design and the War on Sharing. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show comes to us courtesy of Chris. Thanks very much for recording this talk earlier this year in Sheffield, UK, and sending it my way. We have a single speaker, Richard Stallman, who is the pioneer of free software, and he explains what he means by that term and why it's different from open source. Now, as I make this episode, I read that LimeWire, a file sharing company, has agreed to pay $105 million to settle charges of piracy. Now, that's going to go to the large record labels. I don't know whether any artists are ever going to get any of that money. And in one sense, of course, it's a fiction, because money is a fiction, but in the sense that the RIAA, who are maximizing their profits, because they're going to get over $100 million, will be ready to spend $100 million in order to get that. So that's an enormous amount of lawyers, photocopying, air-conditioned offices, and people enthralled in the corporate state doing something which is effectively unproductive, because what's the upshot of this? Not, as we shall hear from Richard Stallman, to promote creativity, but merely to boost the bottom line of various companies. So whilst it may be good for the economy in the narrow financial sense that we investigated last week, what it amounts to in real life is a massive loss for humanity. And this is why I think we can anticipate, as the economy falls to bits, if people are in the right headspace, their quality of life may get dramatically improved. And I've had to cut this slightly to fit. If you'd like to hear the original source material, that's available for download at unwelcomeguest.net/552. So with no further ado, this is Richard Stallman.
This isn't a talk about free software, but it responds to a question that comes out of the ideas of free software. So I'd better start by saying a little basic stuff about free software to provide background. Free software is software that respects your freedom and your community. So it's free as in freedom, not as in price. It's not about price particularly at all. So think to understand free software, think of free speech, not free beer. Now, if a program is not free, we call it non-free software, proprietary software, user subjugating software, because a non-free program is a system of digital colonization. It's a kind of evil empire. Like other colonial systems, it practices divide and rule. A non-free program keeps its users divided and helpless. They're divided because they're forbidden to redistribute it, and they're helpless because they don't have the source code, so they can't change the program. They can't even check independently what it really does. And often these programs have malicious features. However, just saying it respects your freedom is too general. There are four essential freedoms that define free software. A program is free software if you, the user, have these four freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does your computing as you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help others. That's the freedom to redistribute exact copies when you wish. And freedom three You've got to keep it further away so that I'm not going to bang into it. Freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community, which is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. So each of these freedoms is literally the freedom to do something if you wish. It's not required. So if you have a free program, you're not required to run it as you wish. You're free to do so, but not required. If you're a masochist, you could run it as you don't wish. Or you could not run it at all. You must have the freedom to study and change the source code, which includes having a copy of this or being able to get a copy of the source code. But you're not required to ever look at it. You can run the program without ever looking at the source code, if that's what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to redistribute exact copies, but you're never required to do so. The point is, you shouldn't be forbidden to help other people. You shouldn't be kept divided from others. And freedom three is the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions. Once again, if you've made a modified version, you're not required to distribute copies of that. But the point is, you shouldn't be forbidden to.
This would be better.
Maybe, will this be any better? No. Oh, now that's funny. Something changed when it went into my pocket. I know I can. That's sort of obvious. So, if the program gives you those four freedoms, then it's free software because the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical one. But if one of these freedoms is missing, then the owner of the program has unjust power over the users, and the program imposes an unjust system of use and distribution, and that's what makes that program unethical. So with software, there are just two possibilities. Either the users control the program or the program controls the users. If the users have sufficient freedom in their use of the program, and those four freedoms are my idea of what the freedom needs to be, then the users control the program and they control their own computing. But if they don't have enough freedom, and the program, in other words, if it isn't free software, then the owner controls the program and the program controls the users, which means the owner has power over the users, and that's what makes it unjust. So proprietary software should not exist. It's wrong, and the use of proprietary software is a social problem we hope to get rid of. All programs should be free so that their users can be free. And thus, the ultimate goal of the free software movement is the liberation of cyberspace and all of its inhabitants. We invite you to escape from proprietary software and come live with us in the free world that we have built. And I should explain that free software is a totally different idea from open source. Open source is the right-wing reaction against free software, trying to co-opt our work and bury our ethical ideals. If you look at what is said in the name of open source, typically they say that they recommend letting people change and redistribute the programs you write because then they will improve the quality of those programs. So they don't say that users have a right to anything. They don't say that users deserve any particular freedoms. In fact, they usually won't use the term freedom. They only try to argue in terms of the selfish interests of the developer. So, in fact, they end up recommending more or less the same practice, but without the ethical foundation of the idea of free software. So, a lot of people who support open source participate in software development with us. There's no reason, after all, why people have to agree on these ethical issues to work together on a program as long as they agree how they're going to release it. But at the deepest level, the level of values, our views and theirs are totally different. And that's why I am not a supporter of open source, because I want people to think about the ethical issues. What I discovered many years ago, after focusing my effort on writing free programs and releasing them, I then saw that we had given freedom to a lot of people, but they hadn't learned to value that freedom, and they were ready to let go of it for some kind of convenience because they hadn't learned to appreciate it as such. Yes, we need to write the free programs and make them available so people can have freedom, but we also need to teach them to demand freedom or they will lose it again. Because sometimes you have things like the Digital Economy Act and you need to have a lot of people fight in order to defeat them. So if you give everybody freedom and you don't teach them what freedom is, then someone will come along and sell them a scheme to take away their freedom, and they won't fight back because they don't realize what they're going to lose. In any case, the last thing I want to say about free software is that all educational activities morally must teach exclusively free software. And there are several reasons for this. The most superficial is they can save money this way sometimes, but free software is a matter of freedom, not price. And there are more important things at stake here. Schools have a social mission to educate good citizens of a strong and capable, independent, cooperating, and free society. And in software, you do that by teaching free software. Teaching proprietary software is implanting dependence. And the proof is in the way many proprietary software developers donate gratis copies of their non-free proprietary programs to schools. They want the schools to implant dependence on their product so that when the students graduate, they carry that dependence into the rest of society. This developer is not going to offer them gratis copies after they graduate. And if they go to work for a company, the developer is not going to offer that company a gratis copy. So they hope the schools will act as their agents, implanting dependence. It's like giving the school needles full of addictive drugs, saying, inject these into your students to make them dependent. The first dose is gratis. Once you're dependent, then you have to pay. So the school should refuse to teach proprietary software. And those of you who have a connection with the school should campaign to end the use of proprietary software in that school. If you have children who are going to school, you should say, don't teach my children to use proprietary software. And if they offer your child a computer with proprietary software, you should say, proprietary software is not permitted in my home. I want my child to learn to be free. And don't you dare teach my child that sharing is wrong, because sharing is good. Now, there are two more reasons. One is so that people who have talents in programming can perfect their skills, because the way you do that is by writing changes in large programs. The way you learn to work on large programs is you read the code and you write a change. Well, free software lets you do that. Proprietary software forbids that. It's impossible. So only free software gives natural-born programmers the chance to learn to be good programmers. To write good code, you have to read lots of code and write lots of code. It's the same as learning to write good English. Now, there's a deeper reason for the sake of moral education. Schools need to teach not just facts and skills. They have to teach the spirit of goodwill and the habit of helping others. So every class must have this rule. Students, if you bring a program to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share copies with the rest of the class, including the source code, in case someone here wants to learn, because this class is a place where we share our knowledge. The school must set a good example by following its own rule. It must bring only free software to class. If you have a connection with a school, it's your duty to campaign for that school to move to free software. Do it personally in your own dealings with the school, but also bring it up publicly as an issue and look for allies whenever you can. You'll have to keep pushing, but it can succeed. So, at the end of my talks about free software and the GNU plus Linux operating system, which most people don't give us credit for because they call it Linux, which isn't fair, people sometimes ask, do these ideas apply to anything other than software? And that's the question this speech is mainly to address. Usually when they ask that question, they say, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, let's consider that. Remember, were you talking about a particular definition of free, a particular set of four freedoms? So let's see if they apply to physical objects like this one, say. Well, there's freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish. If we adapt that to a physical object, it would be the freedom to use the object as you wish. Well, in general, physical objects do not come with a set of license restrictions saying what you're allowed to do with them. Once you buy the object, you can do whatever you like. So you've got freedom zero. What about freedom one? That is the freedom to study the source code and change it to make the program do your computing as you wish. To try to adapt this to a physical object encounters a problem that there's no source code for physical objects. We have to adapt, we have to change it a bit. It could be the freedom to study and change the object itself. Well, you have that freedom, generally, but the ability to exercise it is usually rather limited. If you have a piece of wooden furniture like this, you could change it in a lot of ways. But something like this that's made up of, say, metal and plastic, and those are hard to change, and there are probably some chips in it, which are impossible to change. So the answer is you've got freedom one, but physical constraints usually make it very limited in the possibility of exercising it. What about freedom two, the freedom to redistribute exact copies? Well, there are no copiers for most physical objects, so this is a completely irrelevant question with today's technology. And likewise, freedom three, if you modify a piece of wooden furniture, you still don't have copiers for it. So you have no way to exercise freedom two or three. Whether you have it or not is not an important question if you can't do it anyway. So that's why their question is sort of silly, because it's a question that, practically speaking, most of the question doesn't have any effect on us. But there are some things for which that question is real and important, things that we can copy and change, and therefore whether we are permitted to do so is an important question. And those are published works that you might have a copy of. You might have a copy in your computer, and then you could use your computer to copy and change them. And this has become a major political issue, a battle between mega corporations and the public. For most works that are published, the main thing that might limit your freedoms is copyright law. Software is an exception, but we're talking about things other than software. So you could ask the same question from the other side by saying, what should copyright say about your copies of these published works? To look at this question, it's useful to look at the history of copyright law, which is closely connected with the history of copying technology. Now, changes in technology cannot touch basic moral principles, which are too deep for them to reach. But when we apply our principles to a specific question, we do it by looking at the consequences of the various actions one might take. Changes in the context can alter the consequences of a given action. They can make it more good or more bad, and as a result, they can change the conclusion. For instance, if we could reliably resurrect the dead, murder wouldn't be such a serious thing. The judge would say, you killed him, you have to pay for his new body. In the U.S., we would all need uninsured murderer insurance. But in civilized countries, the National Health Service would take care of it. Let me talk about the history of copying technology and copyright. Copying began when published works began in the ancient world. At that time, it was done by reading one copy and writing another copy. Now, this technology was very inefficient. But aside from that, it had certain other interesting characteristics. It had no economy of scale. It would take you 10 times as long to make 10 copies as to make one copy, roughly. There might be a bit of a learning curve, I suppose. Aside from that, it required no special equipment other than the equipment for reading and writing, and no special skill other than the skill of reading and writing. Because of this, copies were made in a decentralized way. Anywhere where there was one copy and someone wanted to make another, he would do so. Now, there was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy and you wanted to copy it, you could, and no one would try to stop you, except if the local potentate didn't like what the book said, in which case he might do horrible things to you. But that was not exactly copyright. It was something closely related, namely censorship. That went on for thousands of years, but then there was a big advance in copying technology, the printing press, which made copying a lot more efficient, but not uniformly so. In the ancient world, mass production copying and one-off copying were equally inefficient. With the printing press, mass production copying became a lot more efficient, but one-off copying did not benefit at all because it was faster to write a copy than to copy it with a printing press. With the printing press, it took a lot of time to set the type, but then you could make many identical copies much faster than you could write them. So there was a big economy of scale. In addition, the printing press and the type were expensive equipment that most literate people didn't have. And they also didn't know how to use them. I suppose it wasn't rocket science, but it was a skill. And most literate people had no occasion to learn that skill. The result was a centralized system of making copies. Copies were made in quantity at a few places, and then they were carried to where someone might want to buy them. During the first few centuries of printing, a large fraction of copies of books were still made by hand, either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or by poor people, because, as the song goes, time ain't money if all you got is time. So there were poor people who couldn't afford a printed copy, but had time on their hands and used it to write a copy. Now, copyright began in the age of the printing press. Copyright in England began in the 1550s as a system of censorship. I believe it was censorship of Protestantism under Queen Mary. And the law said that before you could publish a book, you had to apply for permission, and the permission was granted as a perpetual monopoly to one publisher. In the 1680s, this censorship system became obsolete, and it lapsed. The publishers clamored for their monopoly back, but what was adopted in the Statute of Anne was something different, namely copyright as a temporary monopoly for the author. And the idea developed that copyright would be a way to encourage writing. In other words, aiming at a social benefit. So it was not a natural right. It wasn't given to these authors because they deserved privilege, but rather in the hope of benefiting society. This idea was later explicitly stated in the Constitution of the United States. It was proposed that authors be entitled to a copyright, but that was rejected. Instead, the U.S. Constitution makes copyright optional. That is, whether to have a copyright law was optional. It was not required. But if there is to be copyright, it's explicitly supposed to promote progress, and it has to last for a limited time. Ever since then, publishing companies have been trying to get us to forget about that. Now, in the age of the printing press, copyright functioned as an industrial regulation, regulating publishers under the control of authors, but the system was designed to provide benefits to the public. As a result, it was mostly uncontroversial, easy to enforce, and arguably beneficial. It was mostly uncontroversial because it didn't restrict anything ordinary readers could do, so they had no occasion to complain. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers, and it's easy to see who's publishing a book. You go to the store and you say, where do these copies come from? It doesn't require invading everybody's home, everybody's computer, or everybody's network connection. And it was arguably beneficial for the public because the public, according to the way copyright was conceived, traded away its natural right to copy everything, a right which it was not in a position to exercise, and therefore it lost nothing in practice, and in exchange got a benefit, namely the benefit of more works being written. So if you have something that you can't use, it's of no direct value to you, and you trade it for something that is of value, at least it's a positive deal, whether or not it's the best deal you might have got. And because copyright was uncontroversial, if we were still in the age of the printing press, I doubt I would be complaining about it. Now, it was so clearly understood that copyright was an industrial regulation that no one ever tried to attack the people who made copies by hand using copyright law. That's not what it was supposed to be for. Now, that practice mostly ceased when printing presses were mechanized, which happened in the 1800s, and printed copies became much cheaper, so cheap that even poor people could probably afford them. So the practice of hand copying mostly ceased, and the fact that this could be an issue was forgotten. But copyright continued to act as an industrial regulation. But now we are seeing another advance in copying technology, which again makes copying more efficient, namely digital information technology. It makes copying more efficient again, and again in a non-uniform way. Here's the situation in the age of the printing press. Of course, with mechanized printing presses, that becomes mass production becomes even more efficient. But with digital technology, we get this. Yes, both mass production and one-off copying benefit, but it's one-off copying that benefits the most, and it brings the efficiency of these two cases closer together, which means that we're in a situation more like the ancient world, where one-off copying, it's not exactly as efficient as mass production copying, but it's almost so. For instance, mass-produced CDs are somewhat cheaper and more robust than one-off CDs. But one-off CDs are cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people make them. So the result is to completely transform the effect of copyright law. Even if the words of the law were unchanged, the result would now be disastrous because it now has to be enforced against everybody. It's now a restriction on everybody. As a result, it's no longer an industrial regulation. Now it's a restriction on the general public, controlled effectively by the publishers in most cases, in the name of the authors, and usually paying the authors a pittance to excuse the power that the publisher gets. And this is simply unjust, because the freedom that we didn't object to trading away because we couldn't exercise it, we now can exercise it, and we want to exercise it. And as a result, the deal that was made on our behalf is now intolerable. So what would a democratic government that aims to serve the people do? It would say, the people now need the freedom that we traded away on their behalf. We have to take it back. We have to reduce this deal because it's unjust for the people not to have that freedom. So they would reduce copyright power. We can measure the lack of real democracy around the world by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite. They're extending copyright power as never before. For instance, there's the dimension of time. There is a big push to extend copyright law. You see this around the world. The U.S. has extended copyright law several times in recent decades. The last time was in 1998. In 1998, the U.S. extended copyright by 20 years for everything, past works and future works. How they could encourage the writing of more works back in the past by extending the copyright on past works escapes me. If they have a time machine, they apparently have not used it, because our history books do not record that authors and artists set to work with renewed vigor when they learned that their copyrights would be extended. Why don't they use their time machine and get us more great old classics? It's theoretically conceivable that extending copyright on future works would increase the motivation to make them, but not for anybody rational, because in economic terms, the discounted future value, discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright, starting, for instance, 50 years after you're dead, is too small to affect a rational decision about what to make. And in the case of the businesses that wanted 95 years of copyright instead of 75, to justify their claim that this was necessary, they should have been challenged to produce projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future, which, of course, none of them have, because they don't really try to estimate anything that far. They couldn't. So the arguments that were made for this law were all bogus. The supposed justification that this law would promote progress was lip service. The real reason this law was passed is that companies paid for it. Laws are for sale in the U.S. Congress. Companies like Disney, for instance, which knew that the copyright on the first film in which Mickey Mouse had appeared was going to expire, and then everybody would be free to make artistic works with drawings of Mickey Mouse in them. And Disney has obtained so much from the public domain that it's fully aware of what that implies and is determined never to contribute anything to it. So Disney paid for this law, and we call it the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. And another reason they gave was harmonization with Europe. But it's a weird kind of harmonization. You see, Europe had 70 years after the author's death, if I'm right, for copyright on an individual work, and 75 years for an employee's work. And the U.S. had 50 and 75. So this harmonization moved the U.S. up like this. Now, the U.S. has 70 years after death for the individual work and 95 for the employee's work. And that's, I suppose, going to be an excuse for Europe to harmonize its copyright law with the U.S. by adding 20 more years and doing this, and they'll be able to keep making that same moronic argument and ratcheting up copyright as long as basically the media are sufficiently controlled to only show their side of the story. And I suppose if Murdoch gets control of all the UK media, then he'll probably make sure of that, right? So this, of course, is only a temporary expedient. It only gave them 20 more years. So probably in 2018, they'll try to do it again. This is known as perpetual copyright on the installment plan. The movie companies want perpetual copyright, but even they can't change the U.S. Constitution yet. So they have this scheme where every 20 years they extend copyright by 20 more years, and the effect is perpetual copyright, but it's never acknowledged at any moment. At any given time, for any given work, there's some date when its copyright is supposed to expire, but that's like tomorrow, it never comes. By the time you reach that date, they will have postponed it, and thus their aim is that nothing should ever go into the public domain again. But the U.S. isn't the worst. In Mexico, copyright now lasts for 100 years after the author's death. Apparently, they think that the author's great-great-grandchildren or something must be supported when we use the work. Well, time is one dimension, but even more important is the dimension of breadth. Which uses of the work are covered by copyright? In the age of the printing press, copyright was not conceived as covering all uses of a copyrighted work. There were certain uses that were regulated by copyright, and everything else people were simply free to do. So the publishers have recognized that digital technology gives them the chance to seize total control, to impose a pay-per-view universe. And the way they do it is with malicious features in proprietary software. These features are known as digital restrictions management, or DRM. Also, they're called digital handcuffs. And they are features designed to restrict what the user does with the data in her own computer, which she ought to have control over, but not with these programs. And that way, they can impose their pay-per-view universe. They can impose whatever conditions they want and make them impossible to escape from unless their software has a bug. Now, they need proprietary software to do this, because with free software, the users control the program. And so if it happens to have a malicious feature, the users can remove it. They can fix it by making it do what they want it to do. The users control their computing. As a result, the companies that seek to turn our computers against us always do it with proprietary software. And that means they're attacking our freedom at two levels at once. Proprietary software is an attack on the user's freedom because it means that the program controls the user, and the user doesn't control the program. And it's being used to implement another level of control over the use of particular published works. These and other kinds of malicious features are rife in proprietary software. Digital handcuffs can be found in Microsoft Windows, in the Macintosh operating system, in Adobe Flash Player, in the newer Apple products, the iMone and the iPad, and in the Amazon Swindle. So what you can see is being the victim of digital handcuffs is the usual case for users of proprietary software. There are maybe proprietary programs that don't have malicious features, but that's an exception. And the rule is, if you're using proprietary software, you're being victimized and you're being abused. Other malicious features are known as well. For instance, there are back doors known in Windows, in the iMoan and the iBad, in the Amazon Swindle. So the first place that the public encountered digital handcuffs was in DVDs, because DVDs are designed to restrict the user. The movie is typically recorded in encrypted form, and the purpose of that encryption, which was kept secret, was specifically to restrict the users and to make it hard for them to escape from the restrictions. And all DVD players restricted the public the same way, because the companies that made them had to join the DVD conspiracy. The DVD conspiracy's rules said, if you want to make DVD players, you have to join the conspiracy and you have to promise to restrict the users according to in precisely these ways. So they all restrict the users the same. And for a while that worked. But then some people in Europe figured out the format of the encryption and they released a free program that could decode these encrypted files and make it possible to actually watch a DVD without proprietary software. Well, that was a good thing, but the movie companies, which had organized this conspiracy, didn't like it. So they started demanding laws to forbid such free software. And they got it first in the U.S. in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposes censorship on software, and not just on software, by the way, but in software it has the form of censorship. It censors any software that can break digital handcuffs with a limited useless exception. So in effect, our government took the side of the megacorporations against us. The European Union adopted a directive along the same lines around 2001, I believe. And then most of the countries in Europe implemented it in a nastier form than was actually required. For instance, in France, even possession of a copy of that program is a crime punished by imprisonment. Just think of that. People can be imprisoned in France for having defended themselves from malicious software features. Now, I often go to France, so I don't have a copy of this program. I have nothing that can play an encrypted DVD, and I have no encrypted DVDs. I'm content with that. But I think it's okay to have and play an encrypted DVD as long as you have the means to break the handcuffs. In general, you must never accept any product designed to restrict you, designed to attack your freedom, unless you personally have the means to thwart the attack, to neutralize it. In the case of DVDs, if you have that free software, then you can neutralize the attack, and then I suppose there's no reason you shouldn't get a DVD. But I only get DVDs that are unencrypted. The movie companies got the desired support from governments against us, but that didn't solve the problem. The fact is, this software is easy to find. So they designed another system of digital handcuffs called AACS. And they figured that would never be broken. That's used in Blu-ray discs. But then a free program was released to reverse the encryption of Blu-ray discs. However, it wasn't censored because it was useless. In order to actually run it, you would need to know the key, and no one knew the key. And then I saw a photo of two adorable puppies, and above them, 32 hex digits. And I wondered, why put those hex digits together with the puppies? I wonder if those numbers are actually a key, and they are trying to prevent the key from being erased from everywhere by hoping that people will save this picture because the puppies are so cute. And that was indeed the key to break the axe. After a few weeks, that key could be found on 700,000 web pages, which indicates an outpouring of anger against digital restrictions management. But that didn't win the battle in any lasting way because they changed the key. They already had a provision for that. So it was not a lasting victory. And Blu-ray discs have another level of digital restrictions management where they change it every few months, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to keep up with them. So we don't always win. We can't assume that they will always make technical mistakes and that we'll always defeat them technically. We have to fight for our freedom as freedom. So that's where things stand in video. But we've also seen DRM applied to music. That started around 10 years ago. You saw things on being sold which looked like compact discs, but they were not properly written according to the standard for compact discs. So we called them corrupt discs. And the purpose of them was to be playable in an audio player, but not work in a computer. In some countries in Europe, you can tell which ones they are because they don't have the compact disc logo. They're not allowed to because they weren't written as specified by the compact disc standard. So they have a different symbol that says copy control. I once gave a speech on this topic in Spain, where I had been invited by part of the regional government, and the next day I was given, as regional governments tend to do, some books with photos of their region and some records of music from their region. And one of them was by a musician I'd heard of, so I wanted to listen to it. But fortunately, before I opened the package, I saw the symbol copy control. This disc can be played on Windows and Macintosh systems. In other words, only with proprietary software, it seems, and thus not by me. So I gave it back and I said, "Here you see the face of the enemy. Please give this back to the store because they don't deserve to keep your money." And I've never heard that music. Maybe I never will, but all right. That's a pretty small sacrifice to make for one's freedom. Then things got worse when Apple started selling music downloads with DRM through iTunes. iTunes is a pretty nasty thing. Then the record companies started allowing sales of downloads without DRM. I'm told that what happened was their business deal with Apple turned out to put Apple in the driver's seat and was bad for the record companies. And the only way they were allowed to sell it without going through Apple was to do it without DRM. So they tried that, and lo and behold, they discovered they were selling, so they started doing it more. And then Apple basically had to drop the DRM because it had been outflanked. This other places were better. But iTunes still uses DRM on anything other than music, I believe. So that doesn't mean iTunes has now become a good thing. People should not associate with iTunes. And especially schools should not deal with iTunes. Sony came up with a very clever way of making corrupt discs. They put a program on the disc such that if you put the disc into a computer, the program would run automatically. And that program was like a virus. It's referred to as a rootkit, which means it's like the part of a virus that takes control of the computer. That program inserts itself into the operating system and modifies it, and it makes several changes. First of all, it restricts the use of the music on those discs. But second, It alters the program you would use to look for the presence of that software so that it doesn't show up. And it also alters the program you would use to delete that software so it doesn't really delete. Now, this is a felony in the U.S. and maybe here too. But Sony was not prosecuted for this. But it's not the only felony, because some of this code had been released under the GNU GPL. They used GPL-covered free software in there. And the GNU GPL's conditions say when you include some of this code in a larger program, you have to release the source code. And you have to give people a copy of the license so they know their rights. Well, Sony didn't do that. That was commercial copyright infringement, which is also a felony. But Sony wasn't prosecuted because the state understands that the laws are there to give companies like Sony power over us. They're not meant to defend our rights. However, people did sue Sony. Alas, they focused their criticism not on the malicious purpose of this software, but rather on the secondary malicious things that were part of the means used. Thus, Sony was able to settle the lawsuit by promising that in the future, when it attacked our freedom, it would not do so using these particular methods. And Sony learned its lesson, because in the future, the rootkit will be built into the computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove, and it will be called AACS. And that's the way things are in the PlayStation 3, which is an extremely nasty product. In any case, DRM on music mostly disappeared once the record companies began selling downloads that didn't have DRM. But it's starting to come back with the so-called streaming services, these music streaming services such as Spotify, that are set up to require you to use a proprietary program to listen. And the reason is it's designed to restrict the user. They say to you, this is streaming, so of course you can't save a copy. They want people to get the idea that that's somehow natural, but it's just an artificial restriction. Saving a copy of the data received would be the most natural thing in the world, except that that program is written so it won't do that. And you can't use the service except by doing that. So people shouldn't use that. Out, damn Spotify. And now we see digital restrictions management on books. The first attempt was made around a decade ago. There was a massive organized PR effort to convince people that they would all use ebooks. And then the publishers came out with their ebooks and ebook readers. One publisher had the idea that it could start its line of ebooks with a bang among the technology fans by starting with a biography of me. So they sent an author to me asking for my cooperation, and I said, only if this book is published without encryption. The publisher would not accept that, and I said no. So then we found another publisher who accepted that, in fact, wanted to publish it on paper, and they decided to release the text of the book under a free license. So in fact, you could print your own copies after changing the text. And they sold lots of copies and over several years and then stopped. The Free Software Foundation has recently published a revised edition, which is a semi-autobiography, because it has Sam Williams' point of view and my point of view, and they are usually labeled, and you can compare them, and that's under the same free license. In any case, ebooks were a failure 10 years ago. People just didn't want them. And other people said, what a relief. And I said, they will be back. All we did was drive them off. And yes, they've come back. Because, you see, they have people who are paid to try again and again and again. They won't give up just because we defeat their first attack. These devices are designed to take away the traditional freedoms of readers. There's the freedom, for instance, to acquire a book anonymously by paying cash. That doesn't exist for the Amazon swindle. Most books that are available, modern books that are copyrighted still, they are only available from Amazon, and Amazon requires customers to identify themselves. So Amazon maintains a list of all the books that each customer has obtained. And this list is a threat to human rights. Its existence must not be tolerated, no matter where it might be, especially not in a country which imprisons people for having for the books they have, like this one. So that's one freedom. But then there's the freedom to give, lend, or sell a book to someone else, which Amazon denies through digital handcuffs and also by contempt for private property. Because Amazon says that people can't own these books in the usual way. Amazon says it's not really your book. All you have is a license to read it under our conditions. And then there is the freedom to keep the book as long as you wish. Amazon takes that away with a back door. We know about this back door through observation. People saw that Amazon deleted thousands of copies of a particular book. These were copies that people had obtained directly from Amazon. They had previously been authorized copies. And thus Amazon knew exactly where they were. And Amazon sent a remote command, delete this book, and it disappeared. Some people saw it disappear as they were reading it. And the book with which Amazon demonstrated the Orwellian nature of this product was 1984 by George Orwell. A book about a totalitarian future in which they do things like destroy books that they don't like. There was a lot of bad publicity, and Amazon said, we'll never do this again unless the state orders us to. Very comforting, right? The official name of that product is the Kindle. Kindle means to start a fire. Evidently, it's a product that aims at burning our books. It's an attack on society for people who read. Imagine that you visit your friend's home and there are no books. And it's not that your friend is a non-reader, but rather your friend's library is in a device, and the only way to lend you those books is to lend you the device, which would be an unreasonable thing to ask. And besides, you can't even see what the books are. You can't browse through them. You can't notice the things that might be interesting to read. This is basically ending friendship between people who read. So make sure that your friends are warned before they might consider using that malicious product, that it would mean cutting off their friendships. Warn them so that they don't buy it and fall into the trap without thinking. So digital restrictions management is a big threat to our freedom. Of course, you should never accept any product with DRM unless you are ready to break that DRM and you're going to break it. But that's not enough. Because DRM is normally set up by a conspiracy of companies, we need to react in an organized fashion too.